Tax update for Saturday, August 12th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, August 12, 2006. This week we look at a provision in the recently passed Pension Protection Act of 2006 that deals with company-owned life insurance. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file for the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. The Congress was a bit busy recently, and a lot of the press was concentrated on the estate tax provisions and the provisions that had a linked bill with the estate tax and minimum wage provision. And that particular provision, as we all probably are aware by now, did not pass the United States Senate, or in essence was not allowed to come to a vote in the United States Senate because they couldn't get the 60 votes to get to a vote. So that particular bill died, but at the same time, the Congress did manage to pass another bill, the 900-page Pension Protection Act of 2006. And that particular act, while dealing very heavily with items related to qualified plans, has a number of other provisions in the bill that are of interest to us, and one in particular we're going to talk about today. Now, last week I had mentioned in passing there was a provision in the bill that was going to allow for donations of IRA proceeds, one caveat, in addition to the restrictions I outlined a week ago, there is another restriction that it must be for someone past age 70 and a half. So it's a rather narrow restriction on that one. Also, there are some interesting rules regarding documentation for charitable contributions that you're going to need to take a look at that will go into effect and become effective for 2007. Those probably won't have a major impact on anybody's tax return, but they're going to have a huge number of returns that will have minor impact on, or returns where you'll have to tell clients about documenting their charitable contributions. So I suggest you review those provisions. But this week we're going to take a look at what I think is a sleeper in the bill that was placed in there and that deals with a concept called company-owned life insurance. Now, many of us may dismiss that initially and say, well, that's no big deal, no issue, because the provision was added, I believe, clearly to deal with what was referred to in the slang as janitor insurance, or that was in companies taking out insurance policies on their employees basically for tax planning purposes to do various tax issues, to be able to play games with the tax-free buildup of the policy and do other issues, still get a current tax deduction. So there were various reasons why these policies were established, and the Congress got upset about those practices and apparently decided, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore, and passed this particular provision. Unfortunately, like the provision that we found a year ago in Section 409A, or a couple of years ago in Section 409A, that dealt with non-qualified deferred compensation, I think, again, the Congress may have passed a provision that could unintentionally yank in some transactions that probably weren't meant to be yanked in. And if you're not careful, your clients could end up with a major problem if they end up running afoul of these new provisions. Now, let's take a look at what actually Congress did in this bill related to company-owned life insurance. Now, you have to dig through the bill a ways. This is Section 863 of the Act. So if you get that whole Act in front of you, and it's available on the web at the Thomas website, that is thomas.loc.gov, the bill number is HR4. And if you take a look at that, and you go down to Section 863, so you're going to be scrolling for a while, you're going to find that Section 863 makes two changes to the Internal Revenue Code. It adds a subsection J to Section 101. Section 101 is the Provisioning of Internal Revenue Code that generally gives us a tax-free death benefit for proceeds from a life insurance policy that pays off on death of the insured. Again, we all know there are some exceptions like transfer for value where these don't apply and where we end up getting triggered. What Congress has added now is a new trigger that is found at 101J that is an exception to the general rule of the exclusion of the death benefit. As well, Congress added new section 6039I, which is an information reporting section that companies that have company-owned life insurance are going to now have to file annual reports on this insurance with the IRS. And this is another new provision added in the bill. Now, these provisions we need to take a look at. Section 101J is what we'll primarily concentrate on because that's the one that has the nasty impact at first. And you have to understand 101J to get into the whole issue of what 6039I is really dealing with. Now, Section 101J1 gives us the general rule that will apply to tainted policies. And that general rule tells us in the case of an employer-owned life insurance contract, the amount excluded from gross income of an applicable policyholder. So again, remember, we have this special thing called employer-owned life insurance contract, and then we have the applicable policyholder, which is the person who is going to have to worry about the exclusion from income. By reason of paragraph 1 of subsection A, now that's of section 101, which tells us we don't include death benefits, shall not exceed an amount equal to the sum of premiums and other amounts paid by the policyholder for the contract. What that means is, essentially, the tax-free death benefit goes away. The death benefit merely is you take the death benefit into income, but you get to subtract what you might look at as the equivalent of your basis, which is the premiums you paid on the policy. That's a major change, especially since we would hope, in most cases, that the premiums we have paid on the life insurance policy are going to be less than the death benefit. Therefore, this could be a substantial amount of income that would be paid in. Now, we need to be very aware, therefore, of what are these definitions of the significant terms in Section 101J1. And the key two terms to understand are going to be what is employer-owned life insurance contract, because that's the bad type of insurance. If we have that, we have the problem. So we need to know what is employer-owned life insurance contract. What is that sort of contract? Secondly, we've got to know what is an applicable policyholder, because this is the person who gets the bad news, who can't use 101 to exclude the payment from their income. Now, an employer-owned life insurance contract, as you might guess, this is Congress. So sometimes what we say isn't necessarily what you might think the term means in general usage. Remember, I think the best example we have of that is the exception from the 10% penalty for early distributions from an IRA for a first-time home buyer. And you quickly discover first-time home buyer means hasn't owned a home in 2 years, so this could be the 200th home they've owned, but if they kept themselves from owning a home for 2 years, they are a first-time home buyer. Well, it's not quite as strained here for the term, but we do have some people that you might be surprised to discover are employers or have employer-owned life insurance contracts under these rules. Now, the general definition is found at 101J3 Cap A. And that provides that basically we have three tests to apply to any insurance contract to determine if it is an employer-owned life insurance contract. And I phrase it that way specifically because I think you have to, in order to keep from missing some important cases that you might otherwise blow by, you need to say, I need to test any insurance contract to see if it is this thing. Once I decide it isn't, I'm fine. I can skip 101J doesn't apply. But let's apply three tests. There are three real tests for this. First, the policy has to be owned by a person, understanding this is the Internal Revenue Code. When we say person here, we mean person or entity, like a corporation, engaged in a trade or business. Okay, so first thing is we must have a trade or business operating entity or individual. There's our first test. Do we have that person who is the owner of the policy? Is the owner of the policy engaged in a trade or business? And under which such person or the related person described in paragraph B2, and this is where the key is going to come, but basically where the person in the trade or business or a related person, and the related person rules will be important here, is directly or indirectly a beneficiary under the contract. So that's our second test. This entity must be a beneficiary under the contract. Well, okay, I'm the owner of the contract. I own the contract. I'm the beneficiary directly or indirectly of the contract. And the contract must cover someone who is an, the name, cover the life of an insured who is an employee with respect to the trade or business of the applicable policyholder on the date the coverage is issued. So we have to look, was this person considered to be an employee of this entity at the time the contract was issued? Now, if that is the case, then you'd notice, well, immediately it seems like any sort of key man insurance is going to fall under this right away. Also, it should be clear that this definition would bring in any buy-sell agreement insurance that is held by the entity in question. For instance, the corporation holds the insurance policy that will purchase back the stock of the employee shareholder. If that is the structure of the agreement, and if you have a small entity that's not going to be subject to alternative minimum tax, you may very well see that structure in place, or you may see it in place with entities that were formed before the rules came into play that made that an alternative minimum tax problem if your corporation wasn't one of the small corporations exempt from it, but nevertheless had policies that there wasn't a, for various reasons, including potentially lack of insurability of the individuals who were covered, that we couldn't fix the problem. So basically, if the company owns the life insurance policy we're there, or if we have key man insurance that we have because we're concerned that if Joe dies, we're going to need to replace Joe, we need some funds to make that happen. Either one of those would fall into this general rule. Now, also, because when you read the related party rules, you also begin to wonder and suspect that in certain cases, a cross-purchase agreement among the shareholders could cause at least some of the policies to be employer-owned life insurance for this purpose, and it can create a potential problem. Now, as noted, the related party note here deals with the definition of applicable policyholder. That's the reference here to cap B2 above that talked to us about who a related party was. So it's important to look at the definition of an applicable policyholder and especially those provisions dealing with what's the related party rules that we have to deal with. Now, the term applicable policyholder is defined in section 101 J3 cap B. And it provides that the applicable policyholder means with respect to any employer-owned life insurance contract, the person described in paragraph AAA1, which was the old one about employer-owned, who owns the contract. Well, that's good. The term applicable policyholder, any, also though includes, and this is where it gets expanded, any person which bears a relationship to the person described in clause 1, which is specified in section 267B, or 707B1, or 2, is engaged in trades or businesses with such person which are under common control within the meaning of subsection A or B of section 52. Now, you look at those rules, there are some important things to note. The rules we look at under 267B are the rules for disallowance of losses between related parties. There is a list of 13 different relationships under section 267B that create related parties. As well, you're going to find that section 267C, which is applied in interpreting 267B, gives us attribution rules that come into play, especially for attribution of corporate stock. So that means, reading these rules, attributions for shares for an individual's family that's defined in 267(c)(4) are going to apply. So shares held by my family, and we'll define who constitutes family, but if there are shares held by my family, I'm deemed to hold them. As well, 267(b) tells us that if I hold directly or indirectly via attribution over 50% of the shares of the corporation, then I am considered a related party. Well, that makes me the applicable policyholder, and suddenly I'm into this employer-owned life insurance position. Now, when you take a look at that, you discover that the family includes a brother, a sister, and the code goes on and tells us that includes half-brothers and half-sisters, a spouse, an ancestor, and a descendant. So you take a look at who's around. And you pick in. You've got to pick up the siblings. You've got to pick up, and basically then you go up and down the family tree for this individual. You go up to ancestors, you go down to descendants. And you also go to the spouse. So any of those people will give us attribution. If any of those people hold shares, I add them to my shares for determining, for adding up how many shares I own. Now, let's consider the case of a family corporation where the shareholders are two siblings and a parent. In that particular case, all of the individuals are applicable policyholders. And any insurance policy they hold could become an employer-owned life insurance contract in this case, because they are all deemed to own 100% of the shares of the company. Now, clearly this rule was put in place to keep the insurance of people who are pushing the concept of employer-owned life insurance for the tax planning and the tax shelter schemes from just saying, well, we won't sell it to the corporation, we'll sell it to you personally, but it'll be the same basic structure. No, they said, that doesn't work. None of those structures are going to work for us. We're going to get you whoever's holding it. Now, the interesting part is, let's add to our mix. Now, we've got the family-owned companies owned by dad and his son and daughter. So we have those three owning it, fine. Now, let's though say that we end up with not only those three with ownership, but we have an unrelated person who owns 40% of the company. In fact, that's the largest single shareholder. Each of the members of the family own 20%. So dad, brother, sis, each own 20% of the company, and outsider owns 40%. Now we have a buy-sell arrangement that's a cross-purchase arrangement. Therefore, we own insurance on each other, and we're especially concerned about the outsider, so we have the buy-sell there. Internally, among the three, we have the three as a group, and we may have all agreed that, yeah, those three shares, dad shares can pass to brother and sister, and, maybe the outsider doesn't care at that point, that's fine, he'll live with that. But if outsider dies, outsider doesn't have anybody that we want to step in, and he has no heirs he wants to leave it to, so he just wants the company to be bought out because, let's say, his children have no interest in running this company or dealing with this company. So he just wants to be cashed out, so we have a cross-purchase arrangement with him where dad and brother and sis have agreed to buy his shares, and they've taken out a life insurance policy so that if the outsider dies, they will be able to purchase the shares. Here's our problem. The family owns 60% of the company. Therefore, the family is a related party to this entity, and the outsider is an employee, we're going to presume, of the entity. He's performing services, and he's paid on the payroll. He's an employee of the entity, not an unusual situation. Now we potentially have employer-owned life insurance, and potentially under these provisions, it would appear that when the life insurance policy pays off to buy the outsider, dad, brother, and sis will have income to the extent of the death benefit less the premiums they paid. Oh, but they probably only bought enough life insurance to pay the amount of the buyout on the buy-sell. Now they've got a problem. Because they don't have enough in it, because they're going to have to give the money to the estate of the outsider. So they buy those shares under that obligation. They'll have to now reach into their own pocket to pay the taxes on that gain. This is not a good situation. Even more interesting and potentially absurd, let's consider the case of a corporation owned 100% by Joe, XYZ Corporation. He's the 100% owner of the corporation. And he's the sole shareholder employee. Joe's wife, Karen, takes out a life insurance policy on Joe. By attribution, Karen owns 100% of XYZ. What that means is, applying the three tests, we appear to have an employer-owned life insurance contract. Therefore, meaning that when Joe dies, Karen's income would be Karen's death benefit is going to become taxable income to her to the extent it exceeds the premiums she has paid on the policy. Now, hopefully that absurd result is not one the IRS will claim actually happens under this law, or Congress will at least go back and fix the problems, but it certainly seems the attribution rules could cause a wide net to be cast for policies that will fall under these rules. Now, you know, you look at that and you go, well, you know, what did Congress just meant to legislate out of existence insured by sales? At least insured by sales where the entity holds the shares and will redeem them back. Well, essentially, as Congress said, no, we're going to write an exception in the law that's going to cover those situations. And there are exceptions. But the bad news is the exceptions to the employer-owned life insurance income inclusion only apply if you can demonstrate that you met two separate standards, that you did two things before the policy was issued. Your exception involves both notification to the employee of the insurance arrangement and the employee's written consent to that arrangement. Again, both done prior to the issuance of the contract. If that does not happen, we have a problem. But let's look at our exceptions. What are our exceptions that we might be able to get out of? Well, there are two types of exceptions. The first is one based on the employee's status. And basically, we can, if we meet the disclosure and the notification, we meet the notification and the consent rules, we can exclude, we can get out of 101J's inclusion if the insured has the proper status. That means if that person was an employee at any time during the 12 months before the insured passed away. So if you have an employee who is a current employee and you collect on that, you can exclude the gain. Similarly, if you have someone who was an employee within the prior 12 months, let's say he was an employee, he came down, became terminally ill, and basically he left your employ 3 months ago at the final stages of the illness, you could still exclude that from income, presuming, again, you have the consent and you gave the notification. Okay. The second set of tests say that apply not now at when the payout comes, but when the contract is issued, is the employee had the status of a director or was a highly compensated employee within the meaning of Section 414Q without regard to Paragraph 1B2, okay, but basically that's the elective applications of prior years, some other issues there that probably won't really affect you much here in doing this calculation because you're looking at what they were at the time you brought in, or was a highly compensated individual within the meaning of Section 105H5, except that 35% shall be substituted for 25%. So if they're in the highly paid group, the more highly paid group, or they meet the other highly compensated rules that apply to qualified plans generally, then those people can be insured, and that insurance can be excluded even if they were not an employee within the 12 months prior to their date of death. So they could leave employment status essentially a week after the contract is issued, you could get the payoff 20 years down the line. It can be excluded if they meet those tests. Any other employee, they must have been your employee within 12 months previous. My own guess is the reason for that 12-month rule is because most insurance contracts have an annual premium clause, and Congress felt that if, you know, basically we're looking at the time the premium came due, were they an employee? And if they were, then we're going to allow you to collect the death benefit through the end of that period. You don't end up having a problem that the person dies and you had already paid the premium, so that the employee was covered, you know, the money was going to come to you, you paid the premium, and now he dies too late. He dies a day too late, and suddenly you're hurt because he left employee. They said, well, you have 12 months to get it. But you're not supposed to basically, I guess the way Congress looks at that, they consider it somewhat suspect if you re-up the policy, shall we say, as the employer. And we will go through, you could still do it if you meet the next test. There was a second way out. But if you re-up the policy and you're not going to have the distribution go with the second exception. So they were concerned, they were going to let you re-up just because you knew it'd pay off. If you know it's going to pay off and you re-up, then the Congress held that you're going to have to pay tax at that point. You went more than 12 months out. Now, there is a second exception for amounts paid to the insured heirs, and that's found at J2B. And any amount paid by reason of death of the insured to the extent it is paid to a member of the family. Now, this is the 267C4 definition again, so that same brother, sister, ancestor, descendant, and spouse. That's the category. If you paid any of those, it can be excluded. Or the designated beneficiary under the contract other than the applicable policyholder. So if it doesn't go to a tainted person, you know, but the death benefit is paid directly to somebody else, that's fine. Seems a little interesting how that one's supposed to work, but we'll go for that. A trust established for the beneficiary of any such member of the family or designated beneficiary. Or the estate of the insured. So if it paid to any of those, you're fine. So that group will qualify. As well, if the amount is used to purchase an equity, which includes our capital or profits interest, standing alone, in the policyholder from any person described in the first clause. So we first see if we have the proper relationship, and if we have the proper relationship, are we distributing the money to them, or are we using it directly to them, just basically a death benefit? Or are we distributing the money to them in exchange for buying back shares of the entity? If we're doing either one of those, then we can exclude, again, having met the notification and the consent requirements. Now, it does cover a lot of ground, but there are some holes that you may find develop. One that seems to be kind of a problem is going to be, I think, where you have somebody who has a non-spouse life partner. That person will not be a member of the family under C4. And it may be difficult, they probably are not a designated beneficiary for buying the interest back from the employee. So here's the hitch. Employee makes life partner a basically the person who receives the shares of the company on my death. Let's say I have a life partner. I say my life partner on my death, there's a transfer on death clause put in the arrangement, and therefore it goes to my life partner, or I put it into the name of joint tenancy with my life partner. So basically the contract goes to my life partner at my death. And many times you'll see people do that as a way to, you know, save those legal fees, because they're always nasty, we know, right? That's the theory the client seems to have. So we're going to save those nasty legal and accounting fees, and we're just going to do it this way for simplicity, so we don't worry about it and don't pay any fee for somebody to ask. So now the shares end up being held by the life partner. When we go to redeem those shares from the life partner, we have a problem. Now it appears it would not be a problem if those shares had gone to the estate of the decedent. We redeem the estate, and then the estate pays the life partner. That's not a problem. Our problem is when the life partner ends up with ownership of the shares and we end up having to purchase back from the life partner. Now, given those factors, we know we have a few things to go through. But let's presume you think it's workable, we can do it. Now the key is you must follow the notice and consent procedures. The notice and consent requirements are found in Section 101J5. And what that tells us is, which reads, the notice and consent requirements are met if, before the issuance of the contract, the employee, which is the insured, is notified in writing that the employer, the applicable policyholder, which can be the employer or the related party, intends to insure the employee's life and the maximum face amount for which the employee could be insured at all times the contract, at the time the contract was issued. So you have to tell the employee, give notification, we're going to take out insurance on you, and this is the amount we're taking out. You also, now we're going to skip B here, because that's really the consent provision, and I think we probably want to first deal with the notification. And you informed in writing the employee that the applicable policyholder will be a beneficiary of any proceeds payable upon death of the employee. So you have to inform them of those two things. Then you must get a written consent from the employee to being insured under the contract and that such contract may continue after the insured terminates their employment. If you have that document in hand, and it must be done before the issuance of the contract, the code is very clear. It puts a requirement that you have to show this happened before we got the contract. Now, practical matter is, I think most employers who are going to have this issue arise are going to want to put the notice provision in the very document that also will contain the signed consent. Because you're going to want a document both that notice was given and consent was obtained and when that happened. It's going to be very important to put that in. Note, the statute itself does not provide for any corrective procedure. If you don't get this right, if you read the statute, there's no out. That policy is tainted, and your only option might be to kill the policy and start over again with a new policy, a new contract that would not be tainted. Now, it's possible, I suppose, the IRS may grant us some relief, though I could easily see them arguing they have no authority to do so under this code. Or it could be the Congress, when they revisit this, which I think they will be forced to do for a number of reasons, comes back in and puts some relief provisions in the bill. Note, this is brand new, this is buried, so the odds are that as things are discovered and as these issues come forward, we'll probably see some changes and hopefully at least some relief in this area. But what it does mean is you need to be very, very concerned for any insurance contract being issued after the effective date of this bill, because, this provision applies with the effective date, that is the date the president signs the bill. So you need to be sure that your contracts, if you have a client right now who has not issued, who is in the process of going after the contract or getting insurance, but the insurance is not yet in place, you need to wave a flag here and say, wait a minute, we may need to apply these rules, because if we take that contract out after the effective date of the law, but without these consents in place, we have a problem, and we may have a contract that's not doing what we think it was doing. But in addition to the notice, consent, and all those rules, we also have an information reporting provision, and that's found in Section 6039I. Now, 6039I requires every applicable policyholder owning one or more employer-owned insurance contracts issued after the date of enactment of the section shall file a return at such time and in such manner as the Secretary shall by regulations prescribe, which, of course, at the moment, we don't know what that is because we need to get regulations, and I would suspect we will receive an IRS notice eventually on this point, showing for each year such contracts are owned. So remember, we have to have a contract issued after the effective date. And by the way, that's true for 101J as well. Contracts issued before the effective date of the law are essentially grandfathered. But contracts issued after the effective date, 101J applies. And I should say, if you modify a contract enough, you can find you'll trigger 101J, even if the contract itself predates. But if you have a contract that's covered here, your report's going to have to say the number of employees of the policyholder at the end of the year. So you have to give a count of your total employees, the number of such employees that are insured under the contracts at the end of the year. So I have to tell all employees I have and how many I have this insurance on, the total amount of insurance in force at the end of the year under the contract. So I have to total up my insurance and report that as well. And the name, address, and ID number of the policyholder and the type of business in which you're engaged. And you have to also show that you have a valid consent for each insured employee. Or if all such consents have not been obtained, the number of insured employees for whom such consent was not obtained. So you gotta basically tattle on yourself and tell how many people didn't we do this on. Now, the Section 6039IB imposes a record-keeping requirement that anybody holding one or more employer-owned life insurance contracts during the year shall keep the records as may be necessary for determining whether the requirements of this section and 101J are met. That's important because, essentially, in case you hadn't thought this is the way it's going to probably work anyway, they're going to make it clear that if you don't have the records that you got the consents and you claim, well, we had them, but we must have lost them, you know, we don't have the records anymore, it's tough luck. Your responsibility as the employer is to show you met those requirements. And, to be honest, if you fail to file these reports on a timely basis, which you're required to do, the IRS might also attempt to use that as evidence that maybe you didn't get the consents. If you didn't know to file the report, I want to bet maybe you didn't know to get the consents prior to the issuance of the policy. Could be a problem and could be an issue. Now, the catch here is this is brand new. This is something that has just rolled out. But it is something that I believe everyone needs to study and take a look at and specifically consider if anybody is looking at taking out insurance contracts. At least until we get clarifications of how the related party rules work and maybe some new law to get rid of the obvious absurd results. For the moment, I think you have to consider in every case an insurance contract is being issued, whether there is any way the owner of this contract could somehow become an applicable policyholder. In essence, is there some sort of relationship with the employer of the insured that could cause this to all kind of get lumped in? And since there's going to be no harm to obtaining the consents, the theory being, if in doubt for a while, get consents documented, get them in place, and get things going. I would be hopeful the IRS will give us notice and guidance on these provisions in the near future. But until then, we need to kind of work under a worst-case scenario because of the fact that the effective date for these provisions starts on enactment. So you can't wait 6 months for the IRS to finally give us a notice telling us how they interpret it. For the moment, I would start out presuming a worst-case scenario and get consents for anything that even remotely appears it might fall under 101J. Now, this has been the Tax Update. Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Services, www.lineburgservices.com on the web. You can visit them and subscribe to their services because I'm sure they're going to have some more coverage of the various portions of H.R. 4, the pension bill, including the pension-related provisions, as well as some of these other interesting charitable provisions and the insurance provisions. We will hopefully be back with you next week to talk with you some more on Tax Update. I'm preparing in September, going to be on the road a bit, so hopefully we'll be able to keep up with Tax Update. But I've got a couple of things going on. I've got just a general vacation scheduled to North Dakota early in the month of September. And then I'm going to be speaking in Michigan, Virginia, and Tennessee, at least scheduled for now, in September. So I'll be in Michigan in mid-September to talk about construction contracting again. I'll do that provision again. I'll be back in Roanoke for the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference talking about technology again in Roanoke as I have in the past. And then I'll make my way to Memphis, Tennessee. We'll be doing a provision for the Tennessee Society of CPAs on the unemployed benefit plans, an 8-hour CP course then. So I'll be hitting Michigan, Virginia, and Tennessee, working for those state societies, doing various CPE presentations there. So if you're in those areas, wouldn't mind seeing you come by. Otherwise, though, hopefully we'll be able to keep up the schedule in September, and I'll see you later.